If you have an amazingly good memory, or if you're binge listening to these best of 2023 episodes, then you heard last week on the replay with Sarah Husseini that there is a part two of her and I's conversation. And indeed, when those episodes originally aired last year, yes, they were back-to-back weeks. So if you want to listen to that entire chat in one fluid listen, then hit pause right now and scroll on back through the history of this podcast in whatever podcast player app you are using to listen and get yourself to episode 333 for part two. But for now, I'm sticking with the statistics here and coming in at number three of our most popular episodes for all of 2023 was my chat with Danny Meisinger. Now, there are two things that stick out in my memory from this chat with Danny, which is crazy to think about. It was the kickoff to our season four of last year. Number one in my memory is the simple, yet sometimes, if not often, very hard to listen to encouragement that we just have to stick with it. As much as we all search for the magic golden ticket to make this crazy dream work as fast as possible, and as much as there are heaps of influencers on the internet waving attractive sounding courses in our faces about how they can teach us to sell $10,000 in a day or have a six-figure month or whatever other vanity income number they're throwing at us that sounds attractive, when it comes down to it, the majority of the time, success comes from sticking with it. Improving your craft takes time. But over time, you see growth, not only in your own skills and your voice as an artist, but also in the number of people that know about your work, that might buy that work from you and tell others about that work as well. And before I drone on too long about that subject, the second thing that stuck with me from when I originally talked with Danny is his description of making a living. Not making millions, not achieving some level of notoriety or Instagram fame or follower count, but simply making a reasonable living for his family by making things out of clay as a studio potter. Through many of my conversations over these last few years here on the podcast, this idea keeps coming up that making a living from the things that we make is very much a lifestyle choice, rather than just a career choice. Now, to be clear, I am not, and neither is Danny, giving a pass to the old stereotype of the starving artist. Just because you love what you do does not mean you shouldn't also earn a sustainable income. Absolutely not. And also for anyone who helps run markets and festivals and art fairs and shows, can we please stop calling them the Starving Artist Show? Let's just knock that off, okay? In fact, talk of budgets and finances recently came up in the community, and I've started sharing some of my personal favorite spreadsheets that I use for budgeting for the year, keeping track of the health of your business, all of these other financial details, in anticipation of my sharing my entire annual planning process that I use not only at the start of the year, but throughout the entire year, to keep myself on track and get a real-time pulse on the health of my business. It's having systems like this that allowed me to say no in good conscience from a safe financial place last year to new inquiries when I was feeling exhausted. Without knowing exactly where I was at currently in the health of my business, as well as the progress towards future goals that I want to achieve, I would have kept saying yes to just about every opportunity that came in for fear of the moment when those calls stop. I know I would have done that, because before using this system, that's exactly what I did. And thank goodness I didn't do it again, because now, finally, I am slowly starting to feel that exciting energy again about working on new ideas. When last year, I just didn't want to do anything. The idea of responding to an email was exhausting. But anyway, I'm getting ahead of myself. If you want to learn more about all of that, you probably know where to find it by now. But just in case you forgot, pop on over to makersplaybook.com/community and come check it out. I'm sharing my entire annual planning process live on January 8th at 10 a.m. Central Time. But you don't have to worry about that specific time too much because our community is a global one. So it will, of course, be recorded and you can watch that training whenever it works for you. So let's get back to this focus now on making a living with our third most popular episode from 2023, My Chat with Dani Meisinger. Welcome to The Maker's Playbook, the show where we talk all about what it's really like to make a living from the things that you make. I'm your host, seasoned entrepreneur of 13 years, Rebecca Ikiskara. Hey, Dani, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
I am personally excited. This is one of those conversations for me that I feel like starting this, I'm very spoiled because I basically have this excuse to call people up that I'm admiring on the internet and get to talk one-on-one, which is, you know, not normal.
Okay. Let's do it.
For people who don't know who I'm talking to, how would you introduce yourself in the context of making and clay?
I'm Dani Meisinger, and I'll be 57 years old pretty soon. I've been a studio potter for about 35 years now. Married, got four kids, two grandkids. That kind of is almost everything right there. Studio potter. And all that entails and all that's evolved into over 35 years.
I love that you just mentioned evolved into, because that to me is where my brain is. Because at least from the outside looking in online, what I've been seeing is the bulk of your time is Studio Potter. You have your Patreon, you do some teaching, but especially in the United States, making a living predominantly as a Studio Potter is hard to find. You know, generally people have other streams, other support networks, other things going on. And so I'm like, all right, how do we do this?
Yeah, how? It's a work in progress. It really is.
Remind me where in the country you are.
I am near Kansas City. I live in a town called Spring Hill. I'm about 35 minutes southwest of Kansas City on I-35.
Cool. And have you always been there?
Pretty much. I grew up in Gardner, which is the town right now. I moved a mile and a half from where I grew up. My mom's just down the road. My sister's just down the road. And I've been there since I was 12. So pretty much been there my whole life.
That's one of those things when I was chatting with Adam Field to hear how many times he's moved. I'm like, ceramics is not exactly a mobile. I mean, like, you're not rebuilding big magic because you decided you wanted to move three blocks away.
Exactly. Yeah. It's kind of got me stuck now. I was even thinking that as I was building it. We're kind of putting in some roots now. And I mean, the studio is 60 by 100. Okay. So, Well, the barn that I built for it. And so that was pretty deep roots there. And then Big Magic has got me pretty set.
Yeah. Yeah. When you can walk into a kiln, that really...
It's impressive, actually.
It's... Right? Well, it's one of the few kilns, I was joking with Francesco, that like I know by name, which feels... I don't know. It just feels, you know, like a whole nother level.
Well, it's a cool name. And so I can't say that name without giving credit. Elizabeth Gilbert wrote the book, Big Magic. Okay.
Yes.
Yes. And I read that book, and my wife and I, we've listened to it, I don't know how many times, driving to different art fairs or going down the road. She narrates it herself. She's a wonderful speaker as well as an author. And it better articulates what the creative process is and what it feels like than any other person I've ever heard speak about it. And I highly recommend it. It's amazing. Yeah, we were talking about Brian Horsch, is a friend of mine that's come along with this whole process of building Big Magic. And we didn't name it beforehand. You named it afterwards. And so he was talking about like naming it. I've never nearly done that. I've got a kiln that, you know, Pete Pinnell built years ago. He actually built it on an axle and I towed it behind my car. Because he didn't know where he was going to end up. I ended up with this kiln, so I just call it Pete. You know, this kiln, when you build a kiln like this, you almost feel it's incumbent to name it. And so this book is just on the tip of my tongue a lot for while this was going on, and it just kind of popped out and stuck.
I could not agree more, though. I read that book. I don't know if there's a book that I have read faster than when I read that.
We devoured it. Yeah.
It's just, it's also the way she writes is so conversational, but every sentence I was like, yes, 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 that's it. That's it.
And the kiss. Totally. I mean, the kiss is like, what? What are you talking about? And so there you go. Everybody who's going, the kiss, what? Okay. What? Read the book.
Walk us back a little bit over the last 3 decades, almost 4, did you know you wanted to be a potter? Like, did you come straight into it? Or how did we get to this phase?
Okay, so here's the story. All right. So, oh man, there's a crazy side to it that's way preceded that. But I grew up in the horse business, okay?
Okay.
And we showed, my family and I, we had a professional training stable, 33 horses at one point. We showed all the United States. I won a world championship. We, national championships. We were good at what we did. Yeah. And it's a completely, as far as I know, in my opinion, let's put it that way, since we're on like saying stuff for the world, immoral and corrupt business. Mm. And so much fraudulent business transactions happened. So many things that I began to rationalize that were okay. I knew I wasn't in it anymore. I couldn't do it anymore, but I didn't know how to get out. I was 19 years old, never really did anything in high school because I was going to be a horse trainer, like, get me out of here. And so had something happen to me that was kind of crazy, changed everything, my whole perspective. And suddenly I knew I wasn't going to be a horse trainer and I was lost. And the only class I ever took in high school that I liked was ceramics. Now, the other kind of fun thing about this is that when I was in high school, my schedule was all messed up. And this would be the midwinter portion of my junior year. And there was 2 classes I could take. I could take ceramics or a second year of biology. And I didn't even know what ceramics was. I'd never heard of it. I didn't even know that class was in our school. And I was sitting there in the counselor's office thinking, I do not know what this is, but I know it's not worse than a second year of biology.
I was like, don't know what it is, but I definitely don't want to take biology.
Right, bad, but it can be worse. Okay. So I took ceramics and I excelled at it pretty well, but I was always going to be a horse trainer. I didn't even know there were potters in the world. I didn't know this existed. My whole life was horses. That's all I cared about. And so just fat, dumb, and happy, just doing class, messing around, going in afterwards. That was kind of my focus there. And then I got out and it was done. I was never going to touch it again. Yeah. And then when I had that all that stuff happen and I wasn't going to be a horse trainer anymore, I thought, what am I going to do now? So I took a class at the community college, really sunk my teeth into it, really loved it. And then I went to KU for a year and just taking a class. Okay. And so I did when I first showed up, they told me I had to take all the classes and I did that first semester. And then I found out I didn't. So I just had ceramics the second semester and I got pregnant, got married in that order. So life's changing fast. And my wife would drop me off at 6 in the morning when she went to work. I'd run home at 6 or 7 at night, you know, that second semester. And that's when I decided I was going to be a potter. That the Christmas sale, okay, at KU was, I probably had more work than the whole ceramics program combined. And, you know, I didn't stop to think about, I made like $3,000, okay, at the Christmas sale. And, you know, seemed like a lot of money in 3 days. And I'm like, this is going to be easy. You know, and so
famous last words.
Yeah. Well, I didn't stop to think about the fact it took me 2.5 months to make all of it and $100,000 worth of overhead. And, you know, and I was selling them like $15 a piece. And, you know, the whole faculty knows to come there for cheap pots. So there's a lot you don't know. And so, but, you know, if you're not young and dumb, I don't know how you get into clay if you're not young and dumb. You have to be wired that way where you just don't care, you know. Little food, little shelter, just enough and just somewhere to make pots. And if you're not kind of crazy that way, it's tough to get started because as soon as this has to make sense, it doesn't. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, that's how I got started in it. We weren't in the horse business anymore. So my mom let me build a studio in her barn. And so I was there for 20-ish some years. And then finally I moved 1.5 miles down the road, built a studio at my place. Here I've been in about 12 years now. And I just walked down in the back. It's awesome. I'm on 30 acres and the end of a private road. Can't be more perfect.
Oh.
It's becoming a pottery palace, actually.
That's awesome.
A little little tiny Mecca at some point in the future.
I love that the way that you just connected the very beginning of getting this started with, maybe it's because I'm taking an Italian class and so I have like grammar on my mind more than normal, but talking about it becoming a Pottery Palace, and we're talking about 35 years later, like the trajectory it takes to get there, I think that's part of why I started this podcast, because you don't see that on Instagram, right?
It all looks washed.
Yeah, it looks like if somebody started a few months ago and they can't throw, I don't know, 30 pounds of clay, what's wrong with me? You know, like I should be able to do this. And it's like, you didn't see the fact that, you know, 20 years before Instagram was even a thought in someone's mind, you were practicing.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, I tell people the learning curve is steep and long. So, you know, you're progressing really fast. But the nuances and the subtleties that you're not aware of until you look back take a long time to come. And, you know, it's nice to be able to put things in a form of reference for people. And I said, it usually takes about 2 years to make work that someone other than your mother doesn't want or that wants, you know? And so it's tough. Tough to get. And if you're not bitten, you know, hooked immediately, you'll quit. And there's nothing wrong with that. You know, go do something else.
We talk about that a lot just over the dinner table, because I think, and I don't know if it's American culture, I don't know if it's social media, whatever, it doesn't really matter how we got there. There seems to be this cycle that we get bit by the bug that is clay. We love it. We want to do more of it. And maybe it's because it's this medium that does physically take up a lot of space. The urgency I see, and not just see, I did this, right? So pot calling the kettle black here. The urgency of like wanting to put it up on Etsy and sell it, or wanting to even finish a piece, where now I'm realizing, I mean, I'm trying to think realistically. I don't think I've actually fired a piece to completion in for sure 6 months, if not a year. Francesco's the professional. I'm just cutting everything in half again, you know? And I started at the community studio like 4 or 5 years ago. I just realized, oh, hold on a second. Let me do my scales, right? Like to take it to learning an instrument. Let me do these scales for a while before I start putting something back out into the world again, so that it's to a certain caliber. I'm not formulating a cohesive question here, but...
Let me help. So I heard an interview with Ray Charles, and the guy was sitting in with him on a practice session, and he's doing scales. Mm-hmm. And the guy says, well, you know, what are you doing here? And he says, Ray Charles is like, I'm practicing. You know, and he's like, well, I figured you would be jamming. And he says, no, I'm doing scales so I can jam.
Exactly. And,
oh my gosh.
This is where me being a classical musician before pottery pays off, because I'm like, yeah, no, there's no immediate gratification here, guys. You got to like sit at the piano bench a half hour every day, practice, tears, all of the things. And then maybe you get like one great performance in your life.
Right.
Which is weird. Like we have to be hardwired in some very unhealthy way to want this.
Yeah. Well, you know, or maybe, you know, striving for perfection is tough. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so if you go back to Big Magic, you know, to me, this is spiritual substance that we're talking about. We're talking about the creative spirit that exists behind all of this, that is inspiration for us and that can come upon us and help us move forward. And so it's a team effort, you know, with things that are larger than ourselves. And I really think that's what people connect with. The media really doesn't matter. And being creative, I do woodworking. I love doing stuff with concrete, laying rock. I love designing stuff, building stuff, creating something out of nothing. And so, you know, building Big Magic, I wasn't making a pot. I was made a kiln. And, you know, first we had to clear the land and build a building and, you know, pour concrete and do all that kind of stuff. And so I loved every bit of it, and no more than making pots. Or no less, I should say, than making pots.
Well, and let's talk a little pragmatically about that, because I think what's so hard for a lot of us being self-employed, you have to spend the time to do that, right? For you to move forward, to have Big Magic, to make some of the work that you're making now, to all of it goes together. But the amount of time it takes to build a building, even one step of it, to lay the foundation down, whatever... All of that, I was chatting recently with another maker, that is all like unbillable time, so to speak, right? To put it in terms of another industry, and kind of managing that time and being able to make pots that then sustain being able to do that. Like, that's a lot to take into account. And I have a little bit of an assumption that coming out of the horse business might have given you a pretty high risk tolerance, but correct me if I'm wrong.
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting. I've had several apprentices and things, and so I've gotten to know people on a really intimate level about their past and so forth. And so I also look back on mine, and nobody in my family has ever had a job. And they were either coming from farmers or self-employed entrepreneur thinking people. And that's what this is about. It isn't making pots is easy. Selling pots is hard. And, you know, and doing the business side. And so it's about being self-employed and being self-motivated. And if you're a person that needs structure and form around you, this isn't for you. But if I guess I feel like, you know, the blood in my veins comes from, is handed down from people that they didn't think this way. They didn't think about a paycheck ever. It was kind of a completely different, you know, mindset when you get up in the morning.
Speaking of getting up in the morning, the thing that I keep thinking about with that, my extended family are farmers. My mom grew up on a farm. My grandparents' farm is one of my favorite places in the world. And I kind of laugh to myself because I feel like only with that stock in your bones, if you will, it's completely normal in that environment that we've grown up in different ways to work from sunup to sundown also, like in terms of entrepreneurship and, you know, like cows have to be fed, whether it's Thanksgiving or not, like PTO doesn't really work the same way in that environment. And I think that probably also really prepared you for entrepreneurship, I would imagine.
I think that actually is a lot of it. And so sometimes I think there's no right or wrong way. Okay. And so, you know, everybody gets to create their own path and tread that path. And so I'm not sitting here saying that, you know, if you haven't come from farm stock, that you can't be a potter. But I'm just saying that's part of how it's made it more accessible for me, I think.
The calluses were already there, at least.
Yeah. They're not there anymore. I exfoliated all the time.
I think I could still bale hay. I think I could still, actually, I think I'd probably have an easier time of it because when I was doing it before, I was trying to keep up with my cousins that were 4 years older than me, and I wasn't any taller then than I am now, so.
Yeah, I would have a lot of hay. Oh my gosh. Yeah, I still do a little bit, but they're round bales, okay? The machine does the work.
All right, that's a little different.
It's way different, and I like it.
We can reminisce about that, and I'll go down a total rabbit hole now about, you know, hooking the square and thoughts. Anyway, well, are both you and your wife both self-employed, or has she worked different?
She's a yoga and Pilates teacher, and she runs the gallery mostly as well. So I cover a little bit for her when she's got a 12 o'clock yoga class 2 times a week. And then I do about at least, I'd say almost half the Saturdays, probably not quite. It just depends on how the art fair schedule is working and things like that. And our status with the apprentices at the time and things like that. Everything's in flux and we have to make it up almost on a weekly basis.
Has she always been self-employed as well? Or was that different? Like when you guys were, you know, what you were saying when you guys met and you were in school and whatnot?
Yeah, well, we've went to high school together. We graduated from the same class. In high school. I've known her since I was 12 or 13 years old, but she's come from our family as well and a family of self-employed people also. And so it's kind of all fit together pretty good.
I ask because I have been on a mission to find potters or makers who are both self-employed, who have a family, because I think especially at least in the US, it's really hard to find. Mm-hmm. And as someone who's living that life, who's working on starting a family, it's like, okay, I need an example just so that like on the days where this feels impossible, I can be like, no, not totally impossible, hard, but not impossible.
Yeah.
You're the only one I found.
It's almost, well, most of my potter friends have a spouse with a good job. And well, that's the bread and butter, and they get to make the gravy. So yeah, you're right. It's tough. And so I suppose you could say it's doable, but it's tough. Yeah. I tell people, you know, you let the, you know, when you talk about pricing pots, nobody knows how to do it, right? Mm-hmm. But you let the market tell you how to price your pots. Actually, you start low, and if you can't keep up, you raise your prices. And so, you know, it's kind of the same thing, you know, with having that job and making pots. And when having a job is costing you money, that's when you start to think about, you know, whether or not you should get out and go all in them. I don't know. Self-employed world.
Yeah, having a job is costing you money. That is a great litmus test.
Yeah.
Because it is such a, when you are so passionate about it, I understand why everyone's so anxious to get straight into it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, what feels like a lot of money to sell when it's bonus money, all of a sudden becomes a very small amount when it's mm-hmm. healthcare, retirement, groceries, mortgage, yeah. all the things. Oh, I was going to ask if there's something that, you know, if there's been a lot of different kind of business approaches or sales, you know, things that you guys have tried out over the years that has mm-hmm. worked better for your life, or because also having a family and doing the market route is mm-hmm. that's a lot of time. That's a lot, you know, that's rough.
So I've got four kids and mm-hmm. kind of two sets. So they're about 12 years apart, but I'm an art fair potter. And so that's what I was doing. And I didn't do a ton. I know I had friends, man, they were doing 20, 24 shows a year. I don't know when they were making work. I had a friend who did 24 shows a year, made over $100,000 and declared bankruptcy. I mean, it's just like you're chasing overhead. And so there's this fine line, you know, about how much to do and, you know, three bad shows and a person can be out of it. And so, you know, if you're really hanging your head on all that, you know, I had this gallery, which is for just barely making it sometimes, but, you know, it seems like it'll come through a little bit. It's not very good. It's old stale bread when we talk about bread and butter, but it does okay. But it's really been about doing the art fairs. And I only do, right now I'm doing five. And I kind of consider Inseca an art fair as well now with the way the expo has become. It's a lot like that, but it's the coolest one ever. It's absolutely amazing. Like it used to, you know, anybody who's younger than 30 years old doesn't have any idea, but it used to be Ceramics Monthly was it. And so we have this, we kind of refer to Ceramics Monthly artists, you know, or potters or whatever. And it only came 10 months a year. There was a long drought in the summertime where they went on hiatus for 2 months. And so that was all we saw. That was all our visual stimulation was a magazine 10 times a year. And so it was, so when you go to Expo, they're all there. It's crazy. It's every good pot you can imagine is in about a, you know, 500 square foot space. So it's pretty cool. And a lot of them are there and you can talk to all these people that, you know, and ask questions. And basically the whole mission of what Inseca is to me wrapped up just in that right there. If people mm-hmm. can stand toe to toe and just talk to other people, you know, about their work.
There's something so special about being, whether it be virtual or whether it be in person, kind of not having to explain yourself, you know, like when you're in a room of other people, like, get it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like it's just a different wavelength. Yeah. I was lucky enough to experience that really early on with my career with photography, which I think is actually what hooked me into it. Because I wasn't necessarily passionate about weddings exactly. I was coming out of working in nonprofits and working, you know, living and working in one of the roughest neighborhoods in England. And then all of a sudden turning around and shooting weddings where, you know, it was right after the market crash, 2009, 2010, and all these photographers were complaining about people not spending money anymore. And I was like, what are you talking about? People are still paying you multiple thousands of dollars to show up to this wedding. Like, what planet do we live in right now? You know, mm-hmm. now, of course, 13 years later, I understand what some of the problems were, but yeah, it's just wild. I don't know. That was a lot of different subjects at once.
Timing is everything, right? And so mm-hmm. when you came into it, you didn't have the perspective of what the gravy train looked like. And yeah. so it's kind of like the young people now in Clay, they don't understand what, it's just not the same. It's not the same as it has been in all of history. Okay, everything's different just in 20 years. That doesn't happen, you know, in time. And so, like you mentioned, Etsy, it's a really good example. You know, any high schooler with 3 weeks of ceramics can have an Etsy shop now. And it used to be that, man, getting in your first gallery, so huge, okay? Rejection, 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 you know? And, you know, they're saying, oh, well, you know, this isn't the right time. Oh, well, you know, it doesn't really work with the work that we have. And I mean, just all the reasons why. Sometimes they actually told you the truth and said, your work's not good enough. And you had to get back there and you had to go back into that crucible of rejection and work hard to get in that first gallery. And they don't have that anymore. They just put up anything, you know, and to them, it's awesome. It's amazing. I know what my first pots felt like. I thought they were the best things in the world. I still have them and I know I was wrong. Okay. The sad thing isn't so much that people can have an Etsy shop in 3 weeks. The sad thing is that people buy the work. And so these people are getting positive reinforcement that this is good. And they keep doing it. And they aren't going into that crucible of rejection and having to be in that fire and work to get to that first level. They start at the level. And so I really feel like they're missing a lot of that, of those formative forces that cause you to have to reflect and turn back inward.
I think, and what I'm hearing, it is so much parallel to what I saw coming into photography, because 13 years ago, it was the pivot point from film to digital, right? And so you had a lot of guys who were really bitter because 20-something me could come along with my new little digital camera and look, I can take pictures and put up a website. And if I took enough of them, a couple of them were going to work out, right? And what was so interesting, because I knew absolutely fantastic photographer, similar story that you were saying, who declared bankruptcy, who shot celebrities' weddings, who, you know, who just incredibly skilled with the camera, but who didn't know anything about the business side, who didn't know anything about the marketing. And so I saw early on, okay, I want to get good at this craft for my own confidence and because I respect it. But there also comes a point where the person paying me isn't going to know the difference between level 90 and level 100 in terms of perfection and in good. And at a certain point, I had to focus on the branding and the marketing and the sales, because otherwise, I mean, it goes right back to the very beginning that you said, making pots is easy. The business side is the hard part. And that can kind of then be a double-edged sword, because then you have a lot of incredible makers and incredible craftspeople who aren't very good on the business side and so therefore have to shutter their doors, and somebody who's not a very good craftsperson by, I understand art is subjective, aesthetics, et cetera, but like by some basic standards of craft, if you get really good at marketing, well, you can kind of take off into the races and thousands and hundreds of thousands of people know who you are.
Right.
Not to make this the like the bitter episode, but it's just it's just the way that it is.
So I equate this though to, well, so we're going back to the farm now, milking a cow.
It was
going to
happen.
Yeah. So when you milk a cow, okay, you're moving it from one place to another, right? She's going from the udder to the bucket. And so there's a transition and the whole thing gets stirred up. And, but if you let it settle, the cream comes to the top. And what we're in that transitional stage right now, and it's all mixed up. And I've got friends who are, they're such good potters and they got 1,000 followers and they're just not, I mean, they've been doing art fairs for 30, 40 years in like the top art fairs in the United States and just absolutely exquisite, amazing work. And they just can't do it. I don't know what I got lucky. I've actually made myself, I'm actually really burnt out on social media right now. And it's really tough for me to keep going. But I'm digressing in multiple wormholes. Let me get back to the cow. It's all mixed up. And so the part of the problem is that we're all very egotistical. And we measure time in a human lifetime. And it's really short. And when you look at history, you look back and you look at this 20-year blink that we've been in so far. And we're going to probably go on for about another, I'd say 20 to 40 years. But just even another 10 years, almost everybody that's going to be in this gets it and knows it. And so all the whippersnappers out there that are really good on, you know, TikTok and Instagram and all that kind of stuff that don't do good work and should go to the studio and get off their phone, they're going to get obliterated by people who are doing the work because they're just as good at the social media side. And so it will, the cream will come to the top in everything that's going on where it's all about really, it isn't about how good you are. It's about how good you are at social media right now. That will go away. And it'll write itself, but it's going to take time and I might be dead before it happens. So, but that's okay. You know, you look back in history and this is going to be, I didn't even know what it's going to look like. There just hasn't been a time where something just pivoted like this. So anyway, there's all the wormholes just went away. So the milk and the cow allegory, metaphor, whatever, it works. And it's kind of just where we are right now. It's all churned up.
And I think the thing that I see, at least with photography, is, you know, for sure, 13 years ago, when I was that girl who put up a website that I made on Dreamweaver because I had one class in my graphic design degree that I could do that. Yes, I was mixing up the industry. But then also when you do respect a craft and you find some passion in it, you then can become part of the cream. You know, even if you start in there or you start too early, it's like that. I always think of that Ira Glass conversation, and there's a beautiful video on YouTube where somebody did typography with what he's saying, but he's basically talking about the cycle of awareness when you're a creative, right? And you have an idea or you're getting into a new craft, for example, to keep it with pottery, and you just get so excited about it and you know that you don't know anything. You know you have absolutely no idea what you're doing. And then you start to learn a little bit. And mm-hmm. So then you're kind of like, well, look it, now I'm a lot better. Look at this, I'm doing well. And so you have this false sense of good. And then you start to learn a little bit more and you realize just how bad you still are. And then you learn a little bit more. And then, you know, and this, it's this constant cycle of kind of awareness and skill and awareness and skill. And over time, those things start to come together. And that's where I think we're using the metaphor of the cream. And that only happens over time, mm-hmm. I think, which is interesting because there is so much focus on people wanting to learn how to go viral or whatever. And all of that is so quick, you know, like, okay, you could go viral and all of a sudden not be able to keep enough, I don't know, boob mugs in stock, right? Because they're having a trendy minute.
Right.
But then if your sole practice is based off of that, what happens if that stops being viral? What happens when that's no longer trendy? Well, now you have nothing.
How many boob mugs does a person need? You know?
I mean, well, that's it. Maybe that was a bad metaphor because endless, probably.
I haven't got one yet. So maybe I'll help keep it going. Maybe someday.
I haven't.
Maybe
that's
not.
A whole different rabbit hole we could go down.
That is.
But you know, I've always, I don't know, I guess I've just always abided, and maybe it's the musician in me of the slow and steady, you know, none of the businesses I've ever done have ever skyrocketed to success. And I've definitely been the person with the chip on their shoulder, annoyed that somebody else is getting that.
Yeah.
But then when they're not popular, I'm still just kind of like trucking up the mountain, right?
The turtle wins the race.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. There's so many other places to go, too. So I feel like we should get off the bitter social media wagon.
We beat that dead horse, and it didn't get up, okay? It's going to stay right there. All right, so.
And now that we've talked about milking cows, the only visual in my mind is the scene from A League of Their Own when the agent comes in and the girls are, you've seen that movie, right?
I hope. I think so, yeah.
Uh-huh. Oh, you've got with Tom Hanks and Judy Davis.
It's a long time ago. Okay, so that movie.
Yeah. I've got the whole thing memorized. It's one of my favorite movies of all time. But anyways, I completely digress. So tell us a little bit about what life looks like. Well, I'm selfishly really curious about how you guys got this off the ground, too, because I think a lot of people.
We lived with my mom, 30, okay? I'm married with kids, living with my mom. Okay. And I got a studio in her barn. Okay. So without the support of my family and being able to do that, I don't know where I would be right now. I could be where I'm at. I could be ahead. I could be behind. I don't know. And, you know, what does that look like? Because there's more to life than making pots. So that was huge. And so, yeah, I didn't buy my house until I was 30 years old. And so that was a huge start right there for me. Her dad can build anything, and we would build stuff all kinds of stuff together. So, you know, I learned how to do construction. And so I bought a house it was two bedrooms, a single bath. It had grass growing out of the gutters. It had five cracks in the foundation. It was full termites. It was devaluing the land, in fact. And so, but, you know, I can fix a house. And I've increased the size by 200% over the years. I'm still working on it. It's not done yet. The barn's not done yet. But, you know, I basically build everything myself. And so that helps. It's kind of like being a jack of all trades kind of helps in a lot of ways. Not being afraid to make mistakes is the only thing that gets you by. And you just start. The first ones don't look good and you just keep getting better. And that can apply to any medium, including building a house. And you start young and dumb where, you know, $15,000 a year sounds like a lot of money. And of course, 35 years ago, that's a different number than it is now, right? But that's about where I was starting out. And, you know, didn't have insurance, didn't have a lot of things. Hand-me-down cars from my grandparents, just getting by, literally. We could have probably had food stamps for a lot of our lives as well. So if that's what you want, then you could do this. Does that sound sexy? Yeah, I mean, just, we didn't ever get them, but we could have. So, but you know, you love what you do and you always think tomorrow's going to be better. And my wife says I'm a pessimist. I say I'm a realist because the truth doesn't always look good. And so it's like, you're being negative. No, I'm being honest.
I've also never heard a pessimist say that they're a pessimist.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Because we're honest, okay? And just, you don't like the truth. I'm sorry. Okay, not everything is a greeting card. All right. So, but you know, you start to pick things up. You get a commission, you know, a dinnerware commission. And it's like, wow, $1,000. Oh my gosh, that's a whole month. You know, things just start to come along. You have your first good art fair and you realize that this is what people have been talking about. You know, it gets better. You get better at whatever you do. And so if you can stick out the tough times, that's what the hard thing. You know, I'm terrified to borrow money. And so I've always just stayed so far out of debt and so low in debt that I think about my money in terms of annual. And I think that's part of being an entrepreneur, where it's a seasonal thing as opposed to a weekly thing, you know, or an expectation that's going to come, you know, on a regular basis. It doesn't. It's feast and famine. And then you start to get it figured out, and then COVID happens. And then, oh my gosh, what are you going to do now? And even looking back, you can't say this is how you do COVID, okay? Because I know so many people that did what should be right or did what should be wrong, and they both went opposite directions. You know, it's like, it was good for me, actually. It's the best thing that's happened to me in my, what you would call, I guess, is a career. It, you know, I was on a podcast, The Potter's Cast. Six years ago. Well, time is funny now.
Time doesn't exist anymore. Yeah. 2020 just killed it.
It's, yeah. So Paul had this Patreon, was where I first heard about, that's where I first heard about Patreon. And so I checked it out and was like, hey, this would be cool. You know, and I'm still considered a freshman, actually, you know, in the university system. And so I love to teach. And so I'm thinking, this is a way I could do this. And I actually had a site built for over a year, but I didn't have time to make any videos. And the March, when it was a, was it 2020? Is that COVID?
Yep.
Okay. So March 2020, I'm like 2 weeks out in Encica. And Kathy Broski, she's my partner in the gallery. And she and I had just got done spending $700 or $800 revamping shelves and, you know, getting ready to go to the expo at Encica. And like 10 days out, they cancel it because it was just right at the cusp of that whole thing and everything changing. And I'm like, God, I just spent $800. And so it's like, but little did I know that there's more coming.
But this, it's going to be over in 3 months. We'll be fine by summer.
Wait, 3 months? Heck, no way. 6 weeks, you know, and, you know, we'll be on the other side of this. And I don't know, that went down. I was in Fort Worth Art Fair. It canceled. Brookside canceled. And I'm thinking, wait a second, that's my spring. Yep. What am I going to do? And then all of a sudden, the gallery, we close our gallery because everybody's, and now it's like, I got some time. So I start making videos. I put 50 videos on from that time until the first of the year in 2020 on my Patreon. And so that was good for me. And I made a lot of pots. Diana would be like, why are you going to the studio? I'm like, because I'm a potter. And so I would go make pots, and I had a lot of pots, and I needed them because when we, let's see, 2021 didn't happen, 2022, okay, the COVID love fest, and where everybody's going to buy now, I sold all those pots. And it was my best year of my whole life, not just in art fair sales, but in just with teaching workshops now. I mean, the Instagram is blown up, and I got a lot of followers, so I'm teaching at least 4 workshops in my studio, 2 or 3. I taught 2 in Europe last year. That was cool. I got to go to France to this La Céramique, if it put it on your bucket list. Oh my gosh. This place is absolutely a pottery paradise. South of France. Don't have to say anything else.
Does not suck.
Oh man, it was nice.
I mean, to be fair, I met Francesco because I got into an artist residency in Italy making pots.
Okay.
You know, it's like, Yeah.
It's what we all should be doing, right?
You can be really bad at business and really bad at marketing and make that work.
Yeah. Right. Oh, man. So, you know, so I'm doing traveling for workshops. I'm doing ClayCon coming up. I'm one of the 2024 presenters at ClayCon. And so, you know, 3 or 4 outside the studio, 3 or 4 inside the studio, and then Patreon is half my income now.
And all of that happened, just so everybody's really clear, that all basically happened in the last like year and a half, two years at the most.
Three, yeah. I mean, I was starting to get better at Instagram. I basically become a videographer now. I started studying the places that did good. Yeah, don't do time-lapse. It's stupid, okay? Just don't. If you guys were just ready to do a time-lapse video, put your camera down and walk away, right? You have to edit it, all right? Anyway, that's all I'm going to say about that. Yeah.
This brings up one of those points also that I think is, I don't know, if there were commandments in self-employment, this would be one, that you have to have a willingness to learn new skills.
Yeah.
It's going to be a miserable experience if you are not a curious enough person to, you know, I had an English teacher for many years that said to educate thyself, right? And that's, shout out to Mr. Hansky.
Yeah.
You know, because you're talking about becoming a videographer now, you know, there's definitely plenty of potters out there who are like, I'm a potter. I don't create content. I'm not going to spend time doing this. That's not what I want. And it's like, well,
yeah,
this is the world we live in.
Right. So I got another story for you. So shout out to Mr. Shepherd, my accounting teacher. This was like accounting and this, all the sorts of other things. And so this is going to take me back. All right. We're making sure everybody knows how to address a letter. All right. Because people used to do that. They used to write letters. And so he's talking about how you have to print. And I hate to print. What I tell my kids, you know, because they all print. And I'm like, well, that's not how grownups write, you know? And so anyway, just giving them a hard time. But it's real. So I write cursive. And
I was going to say, meanwhile, nobody teaches cursive in school anymore. You just sign your name and that's it.
Yeah. And it's just a scribble, because if you can read it, then something's wrong. But the purpose for writing is to take information and pass it along time to other people who might be interested in it. Anyway, that's me being the dad. Hold on. So he's telling us that we have to print. And I'm like, why do we have to print? And he's like, well, so this would have been 1982. All right. And he saw, well, there's a lot of postmen that, because he didn't have postmen that can't read cursive, or maybe can't read very well at all. And they need to have that printed, you know, to be able to, because there's a lot of them that, so like if it's a 60-year-old postman in 1982, you know, take away 40 or 50 years and they became a postman when they were 17, 18, 16, maybe, didn't graduate, didn't even go to high school, but that was a good job. And they just never learned to read cursive. And he's like, heck, there's people out there that, you know, they never learned to drive because they just didn't need to. They just, you know, getting by fine. And I'm like, I'm never going to be that kind of old, you know, whatever it was that I said. And I can remember when someone was talking to me about, you know, learning more about computers and stuff like that, which I am horrible at. Okay, by the way, I was scared to even sign into this thing. Okay, we're doing now.
And you were waiting for me. And you didn't even need any help.
I started so far ahead. I knew I was going to botch it. Okay. Anyway, I realized I was talking about myself, that guy that didn't want to learn how to read cursive or learn how to drive. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to be that guy. So that's when I decided to start trying. And it was about probably 3.5 years ago now that I started putting an effort into Instagram. And it's worked.
Which I love that timeline, because I think so many people, and look, I'm guilty of this myself with wedding photography and whatever, so I'm not saying anything that I don't also put on me. It's so much easier for us to look at all the reasons something's not going to work, right? It's so much easier. And how I'm connecting this to you saying you put in effort to Instagram 3.5 years ago. In other words, not 10 years ago, not before Reels, not before this, not before that. It's so much easier for us to find excuses, to find reasons that something's not going to work, right? To become kind of a victim in a certain way, as opposed to just saying, okay, well, where can I find a solution that works for me in this? Because I don't think, you know, you don't have to spend half your time becoming an Instagram influencer. You know, you're still making the most of your time, hopefully, and correct me if I'm wrong, making pots. You haven't gotten totally sucked the other direction, I don't think.
Nope. No. And so the thing is, it's like, so there was Michael Klein, amazing brushwork. I mean, so envious to watch him do that. He shared a reel. So you'd have to go to his thing and then look at it. He just, you know, passed it on. And it was this person, you know, where they got this audio in the background talking about how you get to create content. And then, you know, in his comment, later on, he's like, you know, I'm not driving to an art fair. I'm not driving to an art fair where there was a storm and I lost money. You know, I'm not doing this. I'm not doing this. I'm not doing this. I'm not doing this. And so, like, you know, I used to go out and I'd be gone. I'd do three art fairs in a row and I'd be gone for 2.5 weeks with half of that time not doing an art fair, waiting for the next one, you know, because I had to save expense from coming home. And so, you know, in some just flea bit hotel or, I mean, I don't know what. And because you can't spend any money when you're on the road, it's against the law. But now, if I take that time and I put it into this, I'm actually doing less time not making pots, I think, now than I was before when I was out there busting it.
Oh, interesting. So it's less time wasted because you're not in the in-between of fares or driving or transportation or packaging or all the other stuff.
Right.
That's fascinating. So this leads into actually a question that I did have in that you are, you know, you defined yourself as an art fair potter, and it sounds like that's been true throughout the 35 years. That's kind of stayed consistent the whole time.
Yep.
And I want to assume that that's because you saw so much success from that it made sense, or was that just kind of a default? Or I'm also asking because we're going into our first summer of, like, we literally just started applying for shows. So this is like our first year experience of it. And I'm like,
hold on, buckle up. All right, here we go.
Exactly. tell me it's going to be okay, Danny.
Okay. All right. Here's the deal. Depends on where you are in your career. This is so funny to call it that, but that's, I guess, how you approach it. Where was I going with that? So doing art fairs, the thing is, art fairs are the closest thing to Etsy, okay?
Mm.
Because you can start immediately, okay? If you're 3 weeks into high school, you know, in your ceramics class, you can go do a fundraiser somewhere and you can start making pots and trying to sell pots, okay? It's more work than Etsy, but you can get in at the ground level, all right? So you just apply to things with food in the name, okay? And so, which I won't do anymore, okay? But, you know, yeah. Asparagus days, turkey days, fried pickle days, you know, I mean, all these things that have food in the name, okay? You start out at those kinds of things that are not about artwork. They're about a festival, and it's either a fundraiser. There's an ulterior motive here. It's a fundraiser, or it's an ad for a city or municipality of some kind, all right? And they do that at the higher upscale plaza art fair, pointing at it down the road, okay? It's an ad for the plaza. Okay, but you get 350,000 people in a year, and it's one of the top 20 shows in the country every year. And I'm in and out of it. You know, I've probably done it about 8 or 9 times out of 20 mm-hmm. times applying. But the whole thing about that, it's a game show format applying to art fairs. And this might be another podcast, okay? So, I mean, it is a game show, okay? And you have to realize it's a game show before you begin.
Mm.
So you start out going to things. And the thing is, when you go to an art fair, when you put your work out there like that, it's different than a self-critique. It's different than other people coming in. You are with your work in a different way, then you actually learn a lot about it. When you got it there in front of you for sale, this is where the Etsy people don't get this, okay? They don't take the stuff. They don't set it up in the booth. They don't present it for the whole world to be able to come in and say, this is awesome. This is horrible. You know, it's out there. You bared your soul right in front of everyone. And then you sit there, sometimes long periods of time by yourself, and you're able to look at your work, and it actually starts to talk back to you about what you could do different. And you see it differently than you do in the studio. There's so much value to it. Okay, so then what happens is there's two things that goes on. You know, you get better at your work. You get better at presenting your work. And you also start to establish a camaraderie and a friendship with all the people that are around you. And they'll be like, hey, you know, have you tried this art fair? Hey, have you tried this artwork? I think your work would be really good here. And artists are like that. You know, we don't keep any secrets. Well, there are some. They're all dead usually. That's that generation from like the 30s to the 70s. They're in their crypts right now holding their glaze book, okay? Anyway, most potters aren't like that anymore. Yeah, the first thing they do is, you know, you work 10 years to figure something out, and then you call someone on the phone. Check it out, man. Guess what I just figured out? Here's the recipe, you know? But you get better by doing what you're trying to do. And so you just start, okay? And then you got to buy a van, or you got to do this, or you got to do that, or you got to buy these shelves, or you got to, you know, there's all these different things. Then you get into this really big art fair you weren't expecting to get into, but you applied to it anyway, and you got lucky. Now, how you get into art fairs, you have to realize that your work is only seen for 8 seconds, but that's an eternity. When you're judged, because I juried some low art fairs, juried the best, and they're all the same. And they all score like yes, no, maybe, or 1, 2, 3. And then sometimes it's a 1 to 5 with no 3.
I was just going to say, we saw one that was 1 to 7 with no 4. And right. I was like, what does that even mean?
Well, it makes sense. It causes you to tip because that 4 is a cop out. Okay. When you go in the middle, it's a cop out. It's like, oh, okay, whatever. You know, and so you either have to say a little bit yes or a little bit no. Okay. You can't be in the middle. So it's a good thing, actually. But here's the thing. Good work and bad work takes 2 seconds.
Yeah.
All right. So the other 6 seconds with the stuff that you don't, you go, what is it? What? Why is it all different? And then you look at the boost shot, click, and you're on the next slides and you're burning 8 seconds and you know it. And you got to circle something on that last person. It's not going to be above 4. It's going to be below. Okay. So, and something else happened. Like back when the internet was kind of all buzzing and it's all about Facebook, people were sharing these things, these paragraphs that didn't have any vowels in them. And they say, read this paragraph. Then you get this and you're like, why is this idiot sending me this? And all of a sudden you catch a word and then you catch another word, you catch another word. And pretty soon you're reading fluently along this. Okay. You just trained your brain to do that, to read without vowels really quickly. And your brain can do that. Well, what happens when you just couldn't read something because it wasn't clear? Your brain said, you got to do this faster. You need more clarity. You need to be able to read this in a second and a half, because otherwise you're going to be hurting the person that you didn't do well on when you did have them in front of you, and the next person that you've only got 8 seconds on. Mm. What your brain is looking for is clarity. Now, some people in the art world, they love this word, cohesive. Okay. It makes them sound really smart when you say cohesive. You can also say homogenous. It means the same thing. Okay. So if you have a homogenous body of work that reads really easily on slide, you have a better chance of getting. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Okay.
Francesco, we're in.
Okay. Yes. All right. Yeah. So,
because like I said, it's his work, not mine.
That's part of the game show that you have to learn the rules to get into. Now, is it perfect? No. Okay. Anybody want to jury an art fair and have everybody send the work in? Okay. Yeah, that's not going to happen. Okay.
Right.
Plaza gets 1,400 or 1,500 applicants. We picked 200. We could have thrown that 200 out and picked another 200 and had a show just as good.
Yeah.
So at the top, when you're getting up there, it's tough actually to jury stuff. And, you know, there's different things that you do to stand out. Some of your podcasts lately have been talking about photography and only shooting with light from one side. Bob Briscoe started that about 20 years ago, creating sort of drama with shadow. Mm-hmm. And then everybody started copying it. And then it wasn't a big deal anymore. But there's different things that you can do, but you have to present something that is co-homogenous, you know, so that...
The same.
Yeah. The worst thing that you can do is show your best work. You're not in a ceramic competition. You're in a photographic competition. And until you figure that out, you're not going to get in either. Okay. What photographs well? Okay. So you've got 4 images in your booth shot. Do you have 2 verticals and 7 horizontal? Do you have, you know, I mean, there's all sorts of different things. The brain loves symmetry. Okay. That is comforting to us. It shows security. It shows stability. And so that's another reward that you're giving the brain to that juror that's already seen 3,200 images and they're shot. Okay.
Yeah.
So you got to think about, what are the circumstances in that jury room? Are you either be first up in the morning or are you at the end of the day?
Yeah. Cool. Which are all the variables that have nothing to do with the quality of work, right? Like, this is something I learned with submissions for, you know, being published or whatever for photos. I could have a stunning set of images, but if they just accepted, you know, somebody already said yes to, the editor had to say yes to a favor to a friend, and it's at the same venue that I shot at, well, guess what? It's not getting in. Not because the images weren't good, but just because they've already got that venue, or they've already got a redhead, or they've already got, you know, whatever.
Well, another thing that I learned doing work for shows is shoot your smallest work. I was at a swim competition, which is pure torture. Okay. You watch your kids swim for a total of like 4 or 5 minutes. And you actually want to do it fast. So even less.
4 or 5 minutes? Not even.
That's like 5 competitions. Okay. Okay. So
right. I was going to say, if they're swimming the 500, maybe.
It's the entire day. You get to see them for like 5 minutes. Okay. If they're slow.
Yeah.
So you're in the crash room And I'm going through the Ceramics Monthly. I see this image. It's on the cover, okay, of the magazine. And I'm going to just say, mm-hmm. I've seen better. And so it is a massive pot. Okay, it's huge. And so I turn it and I'm going through and just flipping through. And I come to this thing. And for some reason, the cover is on the right-hand side. I can't see the whole article. And it's another piece, massive pot, kind of wonky. And so I flip the page and it's 7, 6, 14, 15 inches tall. And I'm like, why did I think that was 5 feet tall? And it all had to do with camera angle. And mm-hmm. it was shot, if the pot was this tall, the camera was this high, looking up.
Mm-hmm.
You actually look, yep. We look down on our work and we want
the superhero angle.
Exactly. So, you know, it really changed the way the piece looked. But then I also learned a lot when I was juring at the plaza. The buddy of mine, Fong Chu, he does lots of teapots. Well, almost all teapots. And they're this big, okay? But on the wall, it looks this big. It's massive. And I saw my work, and I used to be like, you know, I'm going to bring it. You know, who's going to show a 6-foot pot? Who's going to show a 7-foot pot? Who's going to show a 40-inch wide bowl? Nobody's going to do that. Well, you're not stupid enough. The thing is, I had to be back there to take the picture of it. It looked like I went to Home Depot and bought paint and painted it. There was no detail. There was nothing. That piece was dead. Might have been big, but it looked that big.
Well, and also with the rules around how they want it photographed, right? Like I can't pull out all my photography skills because it's got to be one piece. You know, I can't put a set together so that you can see scale with something else in the image. Like you have no scale of a 6-foot tall piece. If we could
do in the booth shot. So
sure,
you show good work, okay? And like the largest piece I'll show is maybe, I don't know, 20 inches tall, okay? And I'll make sure that piece is in the booth shot, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And in all the pieces that I'm showing, they're in the booth shot. And then there's a 7-footer sitting in the middle. So, you know, it's a game show. And then you get there, it's another game show. Can you set up a gallery in 3 hours, you know, that will withstand 100 mile an hour wind and go in, you know, torrential rains and then tear down in 2 hours and go in a van? I mean.
And fit it all in your car because we're a one car household. So now we're kind of like, okay, do we need to figure out buying a trailer? If we get, you know, we changed which shows we were going to apply to because now we're staying all within the Milwaukee area. Because if we can't find an affordable trailer to buy, at least we can rent a U-Haul.
Mm.
For those weekends and not be $500 deep just to get ourselves to the show in the first place.
I know 3 potters that have had their trailer stolen. Every single, the whole setup, the work, everything.
This is the cue to change subjects. I can't think about that yet. Good to know. All right.
The thieves think there's tools in them.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Boy, are they pissed when they open that door. So. Then they got to sell a trailer. The poor bastards have to unload it. I mean, it's just like it.
You know what we should do? We should all start putting signs in them. You know, if you have to leave your trailer full of pots.
Exactly. This is full of pots. Don't make no money trying to sell this. And it's got my name all over it. You know?
Well, what I'm thinking is you put a sign on the inside that says, you know, dear people who have stolen my trailer.
All right.
If you bring this back to where you found it. No questions asked.
I'll give you $100, you know?
Like, you know, you're not going to want to unload all of this. It weighs XYZ pounds. You know, I don't know. It's worth a shot.
Yeah.
What's one piece of paper? Oh, man. Danny, I could keep going forever. I know we have used up more of your time than planned. So I have one impossible question I do want to ask you that I'm going to shorten my list. Do you feel like since we've talked so much about, you know, we talked about when you were getting started and like at the time how making $15,000 a year sounds like a lot, both when you're young, but also that being 35 years ago. Do you think that you could get it off the ground and start the same now in the landscape that we're in and the reality? Do you think it's, I don't want to say easier or harder because I feel like there's too many variables there, but just in terms of, you know, what everybody faces getting started now, there's easier stuff, in my opinion, with the internet and social media, but there's also harder stuff when it comes to, you know, I don't know anybody buying a piece of property or land the way that so many potters that we look up to were able to do 40 years ago, for example. I did say it was an impossible question.
Well, no, it's not impossible, actually. Not at all, because most of the people are trying to buy land where it's expensive. That's why it's expensive. And so you got to head to the sticks. And like the house I bought, okay, I bought 30 acres and a house and a small barn for $105,000. Now, that was 35 years ago. No, sorry, really 25 years ago, just before prices started going up. But still, it was a steal at the time because the house had the five cracks in the foundation. It was wrecked, okay? Mm-hmm. And it was going to cost money to tear it down in order to build a house. So I found that spot closer than most people could only because of that circumstance. But you can find places in this country where land is cheap and you can build a Morton building and put a room in it, you know, put your house. I know people there right now. I mean, there's lots of people that are, they're doing just that. They're building a barn and then putting a house in a segment of the barn. And to me, that would be the way to go right there. And so it's like the Amish used to do that. The young man, when he left, they didn't, before he could, you know, find a wife, he had to build his barn. He didn't build the house first, built the barn first. Okay, that's where you make your money. Okay, and then you build the house and then you go get a wife. Okay. And she's, you know, like, okay, all right, nice barn.
Nice barn, exactly.
No, I'm not Amish. That's how I've been told, all right?
Right. This is a metaphor, everybody. We are
watching TV going, hey, what? You know, that's not how that works. Yeah. The thing is, they had the order of operations in order, okay? There's a lot of people that don't think about what the proper order is right now. And the thing is if you can do this, but you can't do it in downtown Dallas, okay? Or even the outskirts of Dallas. You got to get 200 miles away. And when I was a kid growing up out here, we drove 35 minutes to the movies. There was one place and that was it, okay? And the grocery store was almost as far. And I mean, it's just, you're way out. And most people don't have an apprentice now who's like, this morning, okay? She was like, look, I've never moved to Wheelbarrow. You know, I mean, she was like, I mean, it's like, that's a city kid, okay? Literally, it was, she wanted me to take her picture for Instagram because she's pushing a Wheelbarrow, okay?
So, it's a momentous occasion. Come on.
Okay. Day one, I showed her how to build a fire in the wood stove, okay? It's her favorite thing to do right now is to build a fire in the wood stove.
Yeah, that's amazing.
So, I mean, there's a lot of people who don't experience life outside of town in country life, but that's where it can't, is possible, I think, you know, to do what you're talking about. If you want to have the small amount of acreage and, you know, build the kiln and build that kind of a life. And the thing is, it's like, what I try to stress with people is that what you're trying to do, you're not trying to make money, you're trying to make a living. And if you take that word to heart, okay, it's a living and it's not about a job. It's what you do for your livelihood and it becomes a part of you. And there's what some people call sacrifice for that, but the rewards are actually greater than the sacrifice. It's just, it's also kind of partly how you're raised, it's partly your own personality, but you know, the things that I sacrifice that other people want, I care less about. And so it makes it a little easier. There's a cost-benefit analysis to everything. And what do you want out of life? And if you want high-speed internet, like right now, I'm doing this. I had to come up to the gallery because we can't do this in my house, okay? And I like that. A lot of times, my phone won't even ring there. And so I'm in my little cave making pots. And life is good there. And I'll get a hold of you eventually. You know, it took us a while. Your first time you connected with me on this was a year ago, maybe?
Yeah, roughly, probably, something like that. You know what, though? That's what's so relieving to me about coming, you know, I mean, I've got feet in both industry at this point, right? Like, there's still part of me over in the events world, and then there's part of me over here in the ceramics world. And it's, you couldn't have more opposite spaces in terms of what it's like to work in them. In terms of, you know, the events world is showy and flashy and, or it can be. My experience of it has been as you climb that ladder, it gets that way. And it's also constantly like, well, you have to respond within an hour of someone's inquiry or otherwise your chances of booking that goes down and all this insanity.
I make no money.
And then here I am talking to ceramicists and I'm apologizing for my delay in responding to someone's email. And they're like, it was only a couple of days. Who cares? Like, it's fine, you know? Like, is good. Everything's fine. I'm laughing to myself thinking about Nsika because, you know, I've been to some really bougie conferences, like intentionally bougie conferences, to where if you're not full hair and makeup and changing clothes for different events and all this, and I'm thinking about Nsika going, if I do it too much, people are going to look at me like I'm weird.
Right. Exactly.
Right. And that's just what's so fascinating, too, is that like so many of the, in my mind, at least, the ceramicists performing at the highest level of the craft are so far away from each other. And that's another thing that's fascinating to me is, you know, you don't have to physically be seen. At, you know, I'm coming out of a world of like you had to see and be seen and show up to the network events. And, you know, you had to build the business downtown Chicago and have the storefront there so that you could connect with people. Whereas this is like, you know, I look at Woodfirers and I'm like, we drove to visit Simon and it's like, you know, nobody's nearby. He's not going to a networking event anytime soon. So yeah. Anyway, to me, it's comforting. It's exciting.
It's nice to know that this aspect of life still exists. Yeah. Even though we feel like we're being pulled into, we are being pulled into this modern world, kicking and screaming, but some of us, which is healthy for us too. So I'm not that old guy that, you know, couldn't read cursive, you know?
Yeah. Ah, that's a perfect full circle moment right there before I keep, because I could just keep going. Where can we send everybody? We mentioned your Patreon. You know, the other nice thing about you teaching, I feel like, is I'm very skeptical. It's ironic because I am an online educator now, but I'm still very skeptical of so much. You know, I saw so many people start teaching so quickly with any skill. And so I feel like your Patreon is the one I constantly reference of like, if you're going to learn from somebody online, learn from somebody who knows what they're doing.
Okay. I appreciate that. As a matter of fact, I teach workshops in my studio, obviously. I post them on Instagram. So I haven't done it lately. I'm supposed to this Saturday. I actually am going to be doing that here in the gallery. But yeah, my Patreon's the best place to actually do that. And the thing is, I try to make it accessible to as many people as possible. There's different tiers where people can sign up as low as $3 a month, which is actually pretty unheard of, I think. And there's 90 videos there. There's, I don't even know how many hundreds of hours of video there is there, but I know what it's like to want to learn. And you know, we harped on the negative side. So the really positive sign about all this is that I know people that are making a full-time living right now in ceramics that have never taken a class. You know, it's been on YouTube. It's been on different sites, you know, doing different things. If anybody better be scared, it's the university system, I think, maybe. Because I don't know what education is going to look like in the next 20 years, but it's going to look different. It's really cool how democratic the education system is becoming. And how accessible, how much more accessible it is. So, you know, of all the, it's kind of like, you know, the difference of I have to make content, I get to make content. It's all how you look at it. It's both of those things, but there is a good side to it too. There's a Hadi, I believe is his name. Young man, a 16-year-old apprentice potter in, I think, Afghanistan that we message back and forth. I think it is so cool that
awesome.
I get to have this relationship with this young man. He'll ask me a question once every 2 months or something, or send me an image of the work that he's doing. And that's cool. And I think that makes all the other stuff kind of worth it.
Totally. Well, I will link it in the show notes, wherever anybody's listening, find the description, they can click away. So, oh man, thank you. Thank you for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
I'm glad to do it. Yeah.
Awesome.
Appreciate you having me on.
If you couldn't tell at the end here, I was clearly unpacking a lot of my own thoughts on how to build a career without being so continuously tied to a computer or even immediately available. Now, don't get me wrong, I love the internet's ability to connect me to so many of you. You've heard me say it before, but the community, our online membership platform, is something extra special and makes me appreciate the ways in which the internet can connect us all from all over the world in ways that we frankly wouldn't have available to us regularly in person. But at the same time, our time with Sandy Lockwood in person in Australia these last 3 weeks, and now re-listening to this conversation with Danny, well, they both have been perfect examples of the fact that you can build a career within whatever boundaries of the life you actually want. Choose your life first.
and then figure out what kind of business model works for you to suit that life. And know that me saying that out loud is also for my own reminder. I'm working on some big changes for myself, and I definitely don't have it all figured out yet. But I do know that with support from colleagues like Danny and like the now over 60 other makers inside of our community, we can figure it out together. If you're looking for more support from people who will never tire of talking about clay or glazing or even shipping and packaging, unlike our very patient friends and family who try but maybe just don't get it in the same way, if you're trying to figure all this out, whether as a side hustling hobbyist or taking that leap to go full time, consider checking out the community at makersplaybook.com/community. I'm still working on my short elevator pitch to explain this amazing space online. But for now, I'll just say, with as much audible passion as I can muster up, it's something really, really special. And as our group grows, it's becoming more and more driven by our members' ideas rather than my own, which I am particularly excited about. And of course, your membership in the community directly supports the creation of this very podcast. I literally could not do this without all of you, and also without the support of our sponsor, Amoco.
Hello, I'm Bryce, account manager and sales solutions supervisor at Amoco Brett, providing you with the best customer service in ceramics. This episode is brought to you by Amoco Brett. Find Amoco glazes and equipment at your local distributor. Welcome to Clay, and thank you for listening.
Audio post-production of this podcast is made possible by help from Christy Kotzfun, with promotional material assistance from Queenie Maliki. The Maker's Playbook podcast is recorded on the original homelands of the Potawatomi, Ho-Chunk, and Menominee people, where the people of Wisconsin's sovereign Anishinaabe, Ho-Chunk, Menominee, Oneida, and Mohican nations remain present. Until next time, my friends, go get back to making your dreams a reality. Because together, we've got this.